Hey, this is Kim Sawyer conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Phil Dorsey on April 30th, 2001. It's 2:45 in the afternoon. We are in the Special Collections Library at Texas Tech. Mr. Dorsey, if you could please begin and tell me where you were born, where you grew up.
Okay. I was born and was transferred a good bit in that job, so if I take you through all of the schools I went to, this will take a while, but so at any rate, moved to Kansas City, Kansas, went to first grade there, and went to primarily Catholic schools all of my life, up to the Army, when I came in the Army, but went to, from there, second grade in Long Beach, Michigan City, Indiana, third and fourth grade in Chicago Heights, Illinois, fifth and sixth grade in Lima, Ohio, fifth and sixth grade in Des Moines, Iowa, and seventh and eighth grade in Lima, Ohio, and then back to Des Moines, Iowa for the remainder of growing up. So I went to high school in Des Moines, Iowa, Dowling High School, Catholic High School. And then from there, went to the University of Notre Dame for undergraduate, and I finished there in 1963. And that's as far as the growing up part, I guess.
Okay. Now, you were in ROTC, is that correct, at the University of Notre Dame?
Yeah.
What made you decide to join that program?
Yeah, that's a long story, too. No one in my family had ever been in the military, that except for maybe some World War II, someone in there and maybe had gotten out, but none of my direct family. So when I went to Notre Dame, at that time in 1963, you had the choice of either taking gym or ROTC. And if you took ROTC, then they gave you money each month.
Okay.
And so it was strictly a decision to have some spending money for cigarettes and beer.
Okay.
At the time. And my decision as to which branch of the military, coming from the Midwest, I always, in growing up, saw the movies, and I thought the Navy was kind of nice to have the white uniform and all of that. So I waited in this, registered for all my classes, and I waited in this long line to get up to the front of the line. It was the longest line. You had the Navy, the Air Force, and then the Army. And so then I got up to the very front of the line. It was my turn, and the guy that was signing people up didn't have a white uniform. He had the Navy blue, dark blue, and I'm allergic to wool. And so I said, you don't have the white uniform on? And he said, no, I'm wearing our dark Navy shirt. And I said, do you mind if I touch that? And he said, no. So I touched it. I said, that's wool, isn't it? And he said, yes. And I said, well, I don't want that. So I looked in the next line. I'd already waited all this time. So the Air Force line was, by that time, had gotten very long. And I looked over, and the Army line was about three people in it. So I went in the Army, and I ended up spending 30 years career in the Army. So that was my decision process to get in the military.
Now, you mentioned maybe some distant relatives had been in World War II. Do you remember hearing any stories growing up?
I really don't. I really don't remember much about that at all. I think one of my aunts, one of her, like a boyfriend, was killed in the war, Navy. Other than that, I really don't know anything about that. The only thing I can remember is what I was told, that my mother has said that when my grandfather was rocking. I was born in July of 1963. So when Pearl Harbor came in December of 1941, I was born in July of 41. So when December 41 came, that my grandfather said, "Always remember, I was rocking you when it was announced over the radio." And so I remember that. I remember some discussion of in growing up about Korea, because Korea would have, I don't remember anything about, of course, the Second World War. But Korea, just remember discussions of family members about that time frame, about it was considered a, not a war, but it was considered a conflict. And you know, people trying to, I remember discussion, what is this, a war? Or, you know, it didn't, it was a, in fact, it wasn't even conflict. What did they call Korea? It was, Korea was,
I thought it was a conflict, but
maybe
I,
it was Korean conflict.
I'm not sure,
yeah,
but it wasn't officially declared a war.
A lot of people died, but it wasn't a war, mm-hmm. So. And then, so I didn't, you know, I never thought much about that, and so I got into ROTC, and I didn't mind ROTC. I didn't, you know, it was kind of fun.
Was this something you would do every day, just like a class, or what did the training involve?
Well, usually there was, like, you'd have ROTC class maybe three times a week, okay. And there'd be a drill. Mm-hmm. Drill every, you know, I don't remember how often you would have drill, where they would march you around, you know. And then, so I was in ROTC, all 4 years, but I had made a decision to change majors and had to switch around. So you have to go to some, at that time you had to go to summer camp for 6 weeks. So normally people would do that between their junior and senior year of college. And with my changing around, I needed to take some summer classes at Drake University in Des Moines. So I did those there in a, and so I couldn't go with the normal group, so I ended up going to the ROTC summer camp at Fort Riley, Kentucky, after I got out.
Okay.
After I graduated from college.
Okay. What year did you graduate?
1963.
Okay. And when did you start active duty, or when did you make that decision that this was something you were going to pursue?
Well, I had a 2-year commitment.
Okay.
For ROTC, because they didn't have ROTC scholarships at the time, but by taking $30 a month or whatever it was, then you had a 2-year commitment. And they had at that time, a 6-month or a 2-year commitment, and I can't remember the, depending on where it fit in, what type of commission you were getting, but at any rate, I was in, at one point in, while I was at Notre Dame, I was in pre-professional. So anyone who was in that, they put in, they sort of branched you the Medical Service Corps administration.
Okay.
And when I decided that, you know, when I switched around and switched majors, and I really didn't know what I wanted to do in life, but I ended up getting a commission in the Medical Service Corps, branch Medical Service Corps. And, I tried to get a change because I didn't necessarily want to do that. Mm-hmm. I would wanted to, you know, go into artillery or go do something like that. And at that time, I don't remember knowing anything about Vietnam in that time frame, 1962. Because, you know, when I graduated from college, went to ROTC summer camp, and then in July finished ROTC summer camp, and then my dad had his own business, so I was going to go. I had a date to go on active duty of January of 1964. So that period of July of 63 to January of 64, I was working with him. And that was in November, when Kennedy was assassinated. So Vietnam was really...
It wasn't in the news at that time.
Not really on the scope, at least
in here.
On my scope.
Did you never thought you would be there when you made a commitment to the Army, did you think you would be sent?
Oh, I never had, you know, no one, you know, kids in college don't think ahead. Yeah. I certainly wasn't.
What about, what do you recall of Bay of Pigs, for instance, some of the other things that were happening just prior to this time?
Yeah, I don't remember a whole lot about that. I know, you know, there were things in the news about Kennedy, once he became president, about the Bay of Pigs, and there seemed to be a lot of misinformation. I mean, I wasn't paying that much attention at that age anyway to what was really going on, and I just knew, you know, just the word was out that it didn't work, whatever it was. But, there just didn't seem to be a lot of good information about that, nor was I, at the time, I guess, particularly interested. It seemed to be something that was way far away there about Cuba.
You mentioned Kennedy's assassination. What were your thoughts on that at the time when that happened?
Well, you know, I thought it was very unfortunate because he was, seemed to be somebody that was really getting our country going in the right direction, and as far as the, you know, going after challenging people to go to the moon and all of that. So I think he was like a breath of fresh air for the country. And whereas, you know, not that there was anything wrong with those that were before him, Eisenhower, there was kind of those people were kind of at the end of their careers, whereas he was really just starting out, I guess, a hope. And so that was, I guess, kind of a surprise. Those two things, the Bay of Pigs one, whether, you know, he got very good advice or he didn't, whatever, and then the assassination, and then all of that was going on about that time with the assassinations. So I guess that was the... I'll always remember I had tickets to the Notre Dame-Iowa football game, and it was the Saturday after he got it, and so they canceled the football game. So that was kind of a big deal for anybody to cancel a football game. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you started active duty in January 1964. Okay, and where were you first stationed or your training?
Well, the Army Medical Department, the home of their training is Fort Sam Houston, Texas.
Okay.
And so all of the, as someone who had graduated from ROTC, then you would go there to the for the officer basic course. Mm-hmm. And it was about a 4-week course for the administrative medical service corps. The physicians had a separate course that they went to, and the nursing, Army Nurse Corps, and the other officers. And then the way the enlisted medics worked is they would go to basic training somewhere else, and then their, like, second 8 weeks of basic training, they would come to Fort Sam Houston. Okay. So the basic training, they called it advanced individual training after the basic training.
Okay.
That would be it. So the basic, and then all of the, like they called the military occupational specialty producing courses, mm-hmm. were in San Antonio.
Okay.
So like if a enlisted man was being trained for anything specific, to be an X-ray tech or to be whatever, those kinds of courses would be down there too.
Okay. Could you describe your typical day during this training?
It was very much a gentleman's course.
Okay.
And it was, we did some, there was classroom, and then a couple of exercises. They had a Camp Bullis where they did some of the field training.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were some thing, you know, some exercises during Camp Bullis. It was nowhere near as intense as the ROTC summer camp that was at Fort Riley, because one at Fort Riley is a basic ROTC summer camp for any officer, whether they're going to be an infantry officer or a medical service corps. It didn't matter what you were going to be. you all did the same mm-hmm. thing, the all base, you know, the arms training for weapons, for mm-hmm. rifle, or for whether it's crawling under the wire while machine guns shoot over you high enough that you don't get hit, but just to give you the... But they did that same drill at the in the officer basic course, where they had the machine gun fire, or the, you know, the
simulated... Is it live fire?
Fire. Mm-hmm. And I always remember the song they would play. It was Connie Francis or Connie Stevens? Connie Francis. It'll be a blue winter without you. So... Anyway, that's the, but it, you know, wasn't really physically demanding at all, as compared to, the military became more physically demanding later as far as running and those kinds of things that you had to do. But back in those days, it was not as, you know, as physical, more physically fit oriented mm-hmm. as it was as the years went on.
What kind of courses would you take as far as the classroom instruction during this time?
They were, a lot of them were like the history of the Army Medical Department, the history of the what happened in the different world wars, mm-hmm. and medical evacuation, and the principles of, they would show how, at that, what the doctrine was at that time, if you would have... if there was, for example, if a infantry division was in a certain area, normally there would be like two evacuation mm-hmm. hospitals and a surgical hospital, and what all those things are, and then they would explain to you what they were and what those units would normally do. But it, it, so it was pretty much a class, you know, classroom sort mm-hmm. of thing.
At this time, was there more talk about Vietnam?
Yeah. You know, by this time, it's January to and February, March. Mm-hmm. And, I, you know, there were some, but it was still, there. You know, I guess it was talk of something that was going on very far away mm-hmm. at that time, and it was still the idea of... whatever I would remember at that time, I think it was more like it was something that I never thought that I would ever be part of. It was just something that was out there. Some people were gone. There were not very many at that time. I don't remember the numbers of the buildup. But there were advisors that were over there and that sort of thing. But I didn't think that at that time I wouldn't necessarily be involved, and particularly once I got into the medical side, mm-hmm. you know, what happened is once I went, you know, I was trying to get out of being in the Army Medical Department, then I went to Fort Riley and saw what they did, and it was kind of fun, and, you know, and I had no idea that I was going to stay in the Army beyond 2 years. Mm-hmm. See, that was another reason.
Yeah.
2 years and out. And so then I went out to Fort Ord, California, was the first assignment.
And what did you do here?
At
Fort Ord?
Fort Ord.
Yeah.
I was assigned, first assignment was to the base hospital. It was a U.S. Army hospital, Fort Ord, California. Mm-hmm. And as like a administrator of their outpatient clinic service. Mm-hmm. At one point, I ended up spending 2 years there. In that job out there, of course, after spending the 2 months, and then as I was getting around to as part of that job out there, I still was going through that part of life where you don't know what you want to do. And my dad had a business back in the Midwest that I could have gone back and been part of, but I didn't really particularly want to do that. And my wife and I got married. She was from Iowa, from Des Moines, Iowa. In fact, we sat down together and got out the Rand McNally and when I had to put choices in on her and Doe, we'd never, you know, I'd moved around. She'd been in Des Moines her whole life. And so we decided, let's go see an OSHA. So I put the, there was one in, I forget the name of the Fort MacArthur in Los Angeles. There was Presidio, San Francisco, and Fort Ord. So I put those as my three choices. And so I got Fort Ord. And so we got married in August of 64. And she was a nurse, is a nurse. And so she started getting, and of course she didn't make any money at that time. And so she was working as a, got a job with a doctor in Carmel, right on the beach there in the doctor's office. So we, you know, we enjoy it, and Monterey, California is a beautiful place. And one of the things that, you know, we would be hearing more and more about Vietnam, kind of a little bit of buildup and what's going to happen. And the one kind of interesting thing that I was involved in is the, we had the responsibility to go around and do ROTC physicals. That are, those are to be done during the sophomore and junior year, to go from junior to senior ROTC. And so we took a, I was in charge of the group, and we had a physician, an optometrist, and some enlisted men, and we had our own x-ray man, and we went down to, down in the Pomona, a couple of colleges in Los Angeles, and then we drove up back through Santa Barbara, UC Santa Barbara, and all of the, I mean, really nice places. Mm-hmm. And we, Santa Clara, went, the only place we ran into any problem was Berkeley. So they're, and so that's about 1965. And so there we are, all in uniform, and, you know, with our vehicles on the Berkeley campus. And so when nobody really bothered us, there were some demonstrations against ROTC, and, but nobody were physically, you know, bothered us. We were much older than most of the students, you know. And in fact, most, many of the students were older with all the graduate students. Yeah.
Were so, these primarily students, as far as you could tell, the in the demonstrations?
Or? Not out there. It was a mix. Well, yeah, I think probably graduate students and so, man, we didn't, you know, think all that much about it. I mean, everybody does whatever they want to do, you know, that was their right. And but that was the only real demonstration that we ran into. And it wasn't anything that disrupted what we did. The school officials, you know, didn't let anything get out of hand. But it never ended, you know, confrontations. Mm-hmm. So that's how we got to that part. And then I was reaching the point where I, you know, there was no freeze of any kind. You could get out. My 2 years were coming up, you know, and it would have been January of, would have been January of 66. And I still didn't know what I wanted to do for sure. So you could extend, so I extended for, I think, a couple of months. Mm-hmm. And I still wasn't sure, and so the only, the next step you could take would be to go indefinite. It was an indefinite status, like I was a reserve officer on active duty, but you could go indefinite. And once you, by that time, there was the buildup, January of 66, and there were units starting to fill up in the state, so it was pretty much known that if you were in at that point, then you probably were going to go. Now, what that really meant by going was, you know, you didn't, going with a medical unit was certainly a lot better than a lot of people that you probably interviewed or some of the others. So I went, put the indefinite, talked to my wife, and she said, whatever you want to do. And so I put the indefinite papers in and then got orders to join the 71st Evacuation Hospital. And they were at Fort Campbell, Kentucky. And so we drove back. They wouldn't pay her way back there, so our plan was to just, she was going to stay in Des Moines, Iowa, where her family was, while I went to Vietnam, or went to the unit that we knew was going to go to Vietnam. And so we moved to, we decided, they didn't know for sure when it was going to leave the unit, so we decided to just, so we went down together and got an apartment in Clarksville, Tennessee, mm-hmm. off the military base, and where several other families were at that time. And so I joined the unit there, I guess would have been about maybe June of 1966. And it was supposed to go any time, and it kept getting slipped, the movement date of the unit. So then once we started getting our, they started sending us the professional category, or cadre, the physicians, mm-hmm. nurses, and all that, started joining our unit. And that's when we knew it was for sure going to happen. And so part of what our, it was to train to get ready to go, and again, classroom training for some of the people were just coming. At that time they had what they called Berry Plan physicians, that they had gotten their school financed through the Army or through whatever, but they had no reason to ever have been in the military, mm-hmm. want to go in the military, so they were called the Berry Planners. So, and a lot of them did just fine. A lot of them thought they were, you know, put upon to have to actually go somewhere and pay back the money that had been given to them, you know, at that time. But I guess my whole thought at that time was that just in, still, the as far as our country was concerned at that time, other than maybe some groups, was that we, the country, was in it to basically to, you know, there was Korea happened, and then not let something like Korea or the spread of communism happen. And that, I mean, that was obviously the thought. And I guess I was of the Midwestern work ethic that if you, like, I went to ROTC and I took what was good, and so this was my turn mm-hmm. to go. And so, and I wouldn't have had to have gone indefinite. I could have gone back to, I guess, could have gotten called up in the reserves later on. But at this rate, I went, decided to go. And so the, do you want me to just keep rambling?
You're fine. Okay.
So the story goes that we're getting ready to go, and it was to be a unit movement, so the entire unit would go. And the way they did that for the evacuation, and mine was a 71st Evacuation Hospital, it's a 400-bed hospital. And so we had a lot of field equipment, you know, tents and all this stuff, and these different sets, they call them sets, kits and outfits of surgical equipment and all the stuff that you need to operate under tents in a field environment. So we have all our equipment, and then we have the people, and so we're getting ready to go. And the an advance party, a certain number of people would fly over, and then they would be there when the main party arrived, and then the main party was to go by ship. So then I was part of the main party. So the people were at the advance party, just waited back at the States, and then they flew over directly to Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And so they were there when we got there. But for the advance party, we flew in a couple of planes, several planes, I guess, commercial rental, and we went from Nashville mm-hmm. and flew out to Seattle, Tacoma, mm-hmm. out there, and then we got on buses and went over to Bremerton Navy Yards, and then so we then loaded on the, it was called the William O. Darby, like Darby's Rangers. Mm-hmm. It's the U.S. Navy ship William O. Darby. And so our main body loaded on that, and we shortly thereafter took off. I'd never been on a ship in my life. And so we got out to sea, and the trip took about, I guess maybe about 18 days or so. The only stop along the way was, the memories of that trip were a lot of, you know, the enlisted personnel had to stay in the lower belly of the ship, and they had pretty much of the, as far as the bunks were really just like you see in those, you know, just the hammock mm-hmm. kind of a bunk. So the, as far, that was a very difficult place to be, hot, and as far as the officers, it really wasn't bad. There were like three of us in a, you know, like a little cabin room, mm-hmm. in the way they had set up. I mean, it was still, it was the most pleasant thing in the world, but it wasn't by any means the worst either. And the ship, you know, the food was pretty good. It was the kind of thing that they would make the, you know, the sound of the bells when you would go to eat, and you'd hear the bells and you'd start to salivate. After 30 days or 20 days on the ship, there's only so much you can do. Mm-hmm. We did stop in Okinawa, mm-hmm. and so we stopped in Okinawa, and then everybody got off the ship, and we had a few hours in Okinawa, and then loaded people back on the ship. And a lot of people had too much to drink when they got off the ship, so the next day was really rough yeah. for a lot.
I was going to ask if anyone got sick, yeah. or were there any problems with people who weren't used to being on ships?
Oh yeah, there sure was. Yeah. There was some like Dramamine or whatever back then. There was some medication. The other thing I'll remember about the trip over, besides that, and a lot of people playing cards, and the famous, I don't know if you remember this, the Notre Dame Michigan State football game, where they were the two best teams in 1964, and it was a 10-10 tie. And we listened to it on the top of the ship, and it was about 3 in the morning. I remember that as one of the highlights. But one of the things that I think is interesting, we had quite a few conscientious objectors that were part of the unit, because with conscientious objectors, of course, they didn't want to carry a weapon, so, you know, the likely place to put them is in a medical unit. And so we had quite a few that were registered and, you know, had all the paperwork filled out right. So we got to Vietnam, and part of this, I guess the good part about going by ship, is all of this counted as your overseas tour.
The day you left port?
Yeah, okay. As soon as you left port, that the clock started ticking for your year's mm-hmm. tour. And we went into the Quinyon Harbor, and they really, it's a loosely termed harbor. There wasn't any, like, place to land the ship or anything. It was land. It was like a, you know, in the mm-hmm. water. And so at that time, they built it up later more, but at the time we landed in, it would have been November of 66. I know I got promoted to captain the day we left from the States. So that was, then we got, so we land, we, you know, came up to Quinyon, and the water was too rough to land, and so we just sort of sat in Quinyon Harbor there for about 3 days, and a lot of little local Vietnamese boats would be coming up to us, and there were quite a few of the conscientious objectors that decided that they would be better off with a weapon. So they changed their category and asked for a weapon to be assigned to him. Because everybody, either officers had 45s, and the enlisted men had M16s.
Is this based on the contact they had with the Vietnamese population?
Just or being on the ship and watching all of these people coming up to him and feeling like they probably needed to have some protection. Then the way that the ship, it was kind of like what you see in a movie. It was a ship that was just like this, and they brought up a, it was almost like a flat loading platform that came up to the ship, and they, with tugboats, and they put it next to the ship. And these are all Navy people doing this. And then they had Jacob's Ladder, you know, the where they throw it out the side of the ship, and you climb down the ladder onto the platform. And of course, we had nurses that had never done anything like that before. And so they'd get a, you know, quite a few people on that, and then you'd go over to the side. They had, from the old John Wayne movies, those loading craft that you'd then climb into that, and then there you'd go in. And so you were in that, you really couldn't see out of it. And then you land on the one I was on, you land on the beach, and the, you know, the gate falls down. And so we have no idea what's going to be there. And so, you know, we had heard briefings about different things on the, as far as the security and some of the problems there. And so we come off the particular one I was on and sort of fanned out and with security, with people with weapons. And the first thing I saw was a group of about three Vietnamese ladies wanting to sell us lemonade. It's the most bizarre. I mean, that, and that's sort of the, that's how you went into Vietnam. It's like you hear all of this and then you get there and it's was totally different. There was nothing going on where we were.
Okay.
And so we met with the advance party, and then what we did at that time is flew up to Pleiku, which is up farther, and then landed in Pleiku. And then once we got to Pleiku, there was a certain area designated for us, and so we just went in, and the advance party had set up some of the living quarters for us, and so the unit just moved in, and we had all of our equipment, we had all of our physicians, all of our nurses ready to go.
Was this standard for an entire unit to move over at the same time?
In those days, in those days, and what the problem with that, of course, is that at the end of the year, they'd all be going home. So they had a program of breaking up that rotational hump, they called it, so you would, you know, send people out to reassign them to different units and then bring other people in, so you wouldn't have that that problem with the DROs, you know, day after from return from overseas. But what happened there, and we were in Pleiku, and the only thing of note in Pleiku at that time was the Air Force had a good-sized land runway, and that's, of course, what we landed on. Then, as far as the Vietnamese, there was what they called two corps headquarters, RVN headquarters. So there was the Harvin headquarters and the advisors that were with them. And then at the time, the 4th Infantry Division was there, but they were farther out, you know, outside of town. And there was, they ran, as I remember, was Camp Holloway. It was one of their main bases out there. So we get there, and nobody ever told us anything about what's likely to happen or anything. And the first night, all these parachute flares start falling, and we don't know if we should be, are we being attacked, or do we turn the lights off in the unit? You know, we had electricity from the generators. And so nobody said you should, you know, like, turn the lights off or anything. It's just a bizarre experience. It was just, I guess people felt that we were pretty secure where we were, and they didn't need to tell us anything, I guess.
What did the parachutes end up being?
They're flares, parachute flares. They just, you know, they shoot them up, and then they have a little parachute flare comes down slowly, so it keeps it up in the air. And it's just a, it's sort of like the same color of light that, you know, is in the some of the parking lots, the sort of yellow color. That's the kind of light it would give off. And you could hear, like, rocketed, or, you know, could hear rumblings in the outside. And then, of course, what we didn't know is there was Vietnamese artillery that was, like, on one side of us that was shooting. And we didn't know that it was, in fact, shooting out, but it sounded like it was pretty close. It was hard for anybody to tell whether that was something headed our way or going another way. And they had a big, what they called, I don't even remember what it stands for now, a TROPO tower. It was a communications, it was TROPO, some communications guy wouldn't be able to tell. But it was like a big disc. And so it was like we had all these targets, the airport, the Harvard headquarters, the disc, and then the hospital. And there also, at the same time, there was a smaller hospital, the 18th Surgical Hospital, had already been there, was operating in Pleiku. And of course, they knew as soon as we got up and running that they were history, they were going to be, had to go somewhere else, so they weren't real receptive to us being there. You know, it worked out over time. But what the policy we soon found out was, after having gotten there, the site where our hospital was being constructed, it was a contract firm, Ringling Johnson or something like that. And it was being constructed over a couple miles at least from where our site was,
our bivouac
site, yes. And so what the policy, I guess, we didn't know any of this when we left the States. Well, a decision had been made somewhere along the line that no hospital of that size will operate under tentage. In other words, it would have to be a real structure. So what that meant was that we couldn't operate the hospital. So here we are sitting there. We have all our people and all our equipment. And so what happened is we had to break up the unit, and we got orders on, you know, so many nurses, send them this way, so many physicians. So we scattered the professional complement, and that left a cadre of administrative, kind of housekeeping to keep the thing going and to watch the constructions, you know, site. And then so it was that way for almost 6 months. So we'd spent, you know, rushing to get over there and then sitting 6 months. I mean, the professional complement, they weren't wasted in any way. They had jobs they wanted to have, right? But it just gave you the whole perception of, did anyone really know what they were doing? I mean, that's a pretty major thing.
What did you personally do during this time, during that six-month period?
We were responsible for making sure nobody killed themselves that were there, or killed each other, the ones that were left. And then working with the construction company and watching what they did. We didn't have much to say, but we would just keep that. And so that was kind of an existence. And, you know, we got to know some of the people in, at the surgical hospital and spent some time with them. And in fact, one of the, they had a ambulance, there was an ambulance company there that provided support to that general area. The ambulance company would pick up, if there were casualties at a battalion aid station.
A ground ambulance?
Right.
Okay.
And if there was a, for example, at a battalion aid station that the 4th Infantry Division would have, some of the ambulances might be part of an ambulance medical company that would then bring them over to the surgical hospital, or eventually they brought them to us once we got operational. But one of the individuals from there, I still have met and kept in contact, and he's the administrator of the hospital in next town up from Round Rock, up I-35.
Georgetown. Okay.
Yeah. Ken Poteet is the guy's name. So he was the ambulance company commander. And so, you know, we got to know some people that you would then be working with, so it was worthwhile from that aspect. But, you know, it's one of those that we really didn't need to be there. We could have come in later. And it was, what happened during that time was there was a policy came out that anyone who was a reserve officer, as compared to regular army, there's a regular army commission and mm-hmm. reserve, and the regular army commission, there was a, once you had one of those, you were in until you decided to get out, whereas a regular reserve officer, you had a commitment of a certain amount. And I had gone indefinite, so that means you can stay pretty much as long as you want to. But there was a policy that came out that anyone who was a reserve officer could go home. But you had to make your decision within a certain amount of time. So here I am, I get over there, don't need to be there, and have the opportunity to go home. I haven't done any of the reason that I came over to be there in the first place. So, you know, I really had to wrestle with that. But that, you know, my final decision was, well, I'm not going to go home and not do whatever it is that I came over here to do. And so, you know, you had to initiate the paperwork to leave. And a couple of our, like our personnel officer and some of the other people left, and they're going on the next plane out of here, back in the States, never part of anything else. But it was just that's just an example of the strangeness of, it was like things would just happen, bizarre things, with almost like no one, you know, people would change policies or they weren't, you know, like what was really happening, you know, and you'd have a, of course, where we were was in the Central Highlands up in Pleiku. And so there was the town of Pleiku, but there wasn't much else versus the big city. Yeah. So I had no experience of anything. Never was in any of the big cities or anything. So my experience is pretty much curtailed or confined to Pleiku, and then going through Cameron Bay on the way to going on and on in Hawaii and then coming back. So that's kind of my experience over there. One incident that while the hospital was being built, we had an officer of the day in the hospital, and so we would rotate them. There were about eight of us or so, and so it was pretty much at that point a 6 day a week operation, and you could kind of relax on Sundays. But whoever the duty officer was had to make rounds of, and you'd have a duty NCO with you, and you'd have to make rounds of the grounds. And one of our jobs was to go over once, I think it was once before and once after midnight, and check this new hospital site. Mm-hmm. And so you would always take, the two of you would go. And because, you know, it was a road that, it was not a traveled road at all that you would go on and go over, and you wouldn't be around anybody else. And I always remember the one night something was going on, and so the duty NCO was busy doing something, and so I said, nothing ever happens, I said, I'll go, you don't need to go along with me. So, and we had a big quarter ton vehicle, a Jeep, and so got in the Jeep, took off, and drove over there and buzzed around, and there's nothing going on. And so on the way back, the transmission just goes out and stops. And so there I am, it's probably 4 a.m, and I'm on the road. I could see the unit where I wanted to go, mm-hmm. and I knew where the road was, but I couldn't, you know, I couldn't walk across the ground. And so I thought, well, okay. And so I had a weapon with me, a 45. And so I got out of the car, or the Jeep, and so I started walking back. And so I could see a figure coming towards me. And the person was walking on that side of the road, and I was walking on this side. And it was a moonlit night, but it was a fairly bright night. And so the person kept moving, and I kept moving. I didn't, you know, so I had my hand on the 45, and it was a Montagnard. And, you know, of course, he couldn't speak English, and I couldn't speak whatever his was. And we just passed each other. And I never knew if that was the time, you know, it was something was going to happen or not. So anyway, I finally walked back. It was about maybe a mile and a half back to the unit. And then we went out and we drove the Jeep back in. And I learned that I should never go alone anymore. But so that was kind of what we did for the 6-month period, the group that mm-hmm. I was with. And maybe it's not that long. Maybe it was 5 months. It seemed like a long time. And then what happened was the next step is they opened the hospital, and it was released to us to move the equipment in. So, and they were all Quonset huts, mostly Quonset huts, the living areas. And then the hospital itself were rectangular buildings. And so we started getting our nurses and our physicians back, and it really became a hospital at that time. And we started getting casualties in, and it became, you know, much more of an operating concern. I do remember one of the questions in there was in the survey is about drugs, and I never saw much over there in our own unit. As the officer of the day, you know, you had to go around, and I remember in one area where the duty NCO and I had found some, and Kent cigarettes for some reason were very popular with, to put the marijuana in the Kent. And I don't know if that's still true, or if Kents even exist anymore. But at that time, I smoked Kents. And I always remember I came back, and I had the marijuana Kents with me. And, you know, I was just, what you do is you would save up stuff and report it to the MPs, and they'd come over the next day and just take it away, do whatever they did with it. And so I always remember I was in just filling out a report of my tour duty, and it was, and, you know, I was having a cigarette, and I reached to get my next one, and I was trying to figure out which pack of Kents is. But anyway, I had set them over there far enough to the side. But that was really the only, I mean, there was some use of marijuana, but I, you know, there was really nothing. I never saw anything among the officers. Mm-hmm. But we had, once they got the hospital built, they had built a a covered kind of a gymnasium kind of a thing. It was, wasn't fancy. It just had like cement in it. They built us an officers' club, and the Air Force came over and helped us build a basketball court. It was all on clay. You know, it wasn't anything. But once we had that, I mean, we had all the essentials in life. One of the other incidences I mentioned of the one officer that was able to go home, one of the, I remember names of all these people, and I don't know that I should necessarily put names in there.
It's up to you. It's fine if you do or if you'd rather not.
But as far as, I mean, for their confidentiality, but there was I mentioned to her, a personnel officer went home. Well, he was replaced with a guy who was really a nice guy. He was a little high strung in that. But I was in my office, and the one of the NCOs that worked, this was after our hospital was up and running, and they said, would you come with us? Captain so-and-so is in his hooch, and he has a weapon. And so I went up with him, and, you know, I knocked on the door and made sure he knew who I was, and I'm coming in. And it was a, you know, it was a Quonset hut with like about eight people could sleep there, so it wasn't like rooms or anything. And then you had your bunk, and you had this mosquito netting over it. And so he was sitting there, and he had a 45 right next to him. And so I just sat alone. I walked over towards him, and as you know, I was able to get close enough and sort of pat him on the head, and was able to, as I came to him, was able to move the weapon with my left hand and then just sit down, you know, next to him. And so he was, the only thing he really said is he felt that he didn't share with his wife that he volunteered. So, but anyway, the long and short of that was, so, you know, he just sort of was, he was done at that point. So what they did is they just, they reported, or we, you know, got the physicians involved, and they reported it. And next thing we knew, a helicopter came in and took him. He was gone, I'm sure out of country. So, you know, that kind of thing happened. I'm not sure, but at least in that kind of thing. And, you know, we were by no means under any fire or any pressure like that or anything. And still you had people that would do that. The only time that our unit, while I was there, actually took fire was that we were rocketed, seen rockets in the compound on one occasion, and there was some damage down at the far end where some of our supplies were located in a supply area, but nobody was injured. Later, after I left in November 67, and the Tet Offensive was shortly after that, and there was a lot more action in the Central Highlands. But so ours was, once, you know, experience of going from not being operational at all until having, you know, a real operating hospital. And so from that aspect, I think it was worth staying there. One of the clubs, this is an experience I had. I got a ride. I was due to leave in about 2 or 3 weeks. And then one of the medevac pilots, and of course those are really brave guys. They're the ones that really were going in and getting the you know, the people were injured out. And at that time, and after that, they were like every year or so were being reassigned to Vietnam. So, I mean, that's a group of people that I'm sure have a lot of stories, and I know they do. But the one I will tell you is anecdotal. Is, so I went over to, it was a dust-off party, and one of the pilots that used to deliver to us invited me over there. So I went over, got a ride over there. So I was there and with him, and drinking beer, and he was drinking beer. And it got, you know, late in the evening. He said, do you need a ride home? And I said, sure. And so we got up, and we're walking down the parking lot, and we get to the point where I don't see any more vehicles. I said, where are we going? So we fly back. And so, you know, I had not enough sense. So I rode with him. We jump in there, and he's flying back. And he'd had more liquor than he. So, I mean, that, the guys that were the medevac pilots, I mean, they were real courageous people. Now, also, probably in some cases, didn't do the right thing. I know neither he nor I did that. But overall, I would say that the experience in Vietnam was, you know, there are probably a lot of people that being a long ways from their family probably got into sexual relationships that just because they were there. And that certainly was true in the group I was in. I mean, the group I was in, there were, you know, you never knew what you'd see next. And not to include the Air Force. And, you know, but in general, I think, I don't think it was anything that you wouldn't expect any place that far away. So I think in overall, I don't know that my experience was, it certainly wasn't as dangerous as most people that went. As a married person, met my wife in Hawaii, and we did, you know, had a 7-day R&R in Hawaii, and went, and I think both going on R&R, and then when I left country, we flew back, and so I think in both cases I flew out of Cameron Bay, so I got to see that area, that hospital area, and the beach, and that's one of the prettiest parts of Vietnam, I think, Cameron Bay. The one thing I forgot that I put in the survey there, as a hospital unit, a lot of medical units did civic action projects, MedCap, mm-hmm. Medical Civic Action Project. Well, our hospital commander had some strange ideas about things we ought to do. He thought that we ought to take a lot of our vehicles and collect garbage in the city. Pleiku City. Mm-hmm. That was one of his ideas. I got involved in that, and he gave that project to me. So I had to arrange for, we had pickup times at various places, and that we would go by and get the garbage, put them in our deuce and a half trucks, and drive them to the dump or whatever, and there'd be people picking over them and all of that. So, I mean, we were just moving garbage from one place to another, I don't know. So we had that. We had some of the people taking care of the, kids and conducting clinics. So the physicians and nurses were doing some of that out there too. But the garbage collection of Pleiku City was my project.
Could you describe Pleiku City?
It was, at the time, it was, well, it seemed dirty, but it was dirty, but not dirty like a big city. Mm-hmm. It was more, you know, there were some parts of it that were like schools, and there were some homes that were very nice. And then there was a lot of poverty, too. So it was kind of a mixture. And it had some more ornate things in it. So I don't think it was as pretty, probably, as some of the other cities that there are, or that there were. But, you know, they had some of the houses had courtyards, and that there were the, I would say the courtyards in the schools, the houses with courtyards in the schools were probably the prettiest things. One of the thing that always struck me about Vietnam was the number of, and I put that in the report, the number of males who didn't seem to be fighting. They were on bicycles, wearing their flip-flop shoes, and while we had Americans, I mean, that always just didn't seem like there would, they'd be right there next to us. And I'm sure a lot of them were, and I didn't see, and maybe a lot of these people weren't medically capable of being out there, but the perception that I had was these people, males, just kind of hanging around. And it really came home to me again. I had a tour much later in 79 in Korea. And the Koreans are tough people. I mean, the soldiers, running up and down. And the Korean people and the Vietnam males versus the males, Vietnamese that I saw, it was like night and day. And again, I didn't see, I'm sure there were courageous Vietnamese males too. They weren't in the group I saw. The ones I saw were always out riding their bikes and stuff. So I always, that was just another, there were just some bizarre things that stick in my mind about Vietnam. And then you would always, and I would go to different briefings that would be held at the, at the headquarters of in Pleiku there, the military headquarters. And I would go to some of the security briefings representing the hospital. And, they would be talking about different threats in different parts mm-hmm. of the area surrounding Pleiku and over into Laos and so on. And they would always be giving all of these body counts and tremendous numbers of casualties that we had inflicted on the Vietnamese. And we're back in the 66, 67 time frame. And what it seemed to me at that point is that eventually they're going to run out of people. Now, and unless these numbers are not right.
Did you get a sense that they might be inflated at that time? Or what?
It seemed strange. It didn't seem right. It didn't connect. You're always having very positive things and how, how we went in and totally annihilated a group of people or whatever it was. There was never any discussion of a My Lai or any incident like that. Nothing, there was never any scuttlebutt even about anything like that. So anything like that that happened didn't happen in at least the area where I was. It wasn't, no one knew about anything like that. And I think for the most part, the people who were there, the Americans that were there felt that they were doing their job, but they're all ready to go home. No one wanted to stay. Some people wanted to stay, but you always wondered why they wanted to stay. Was there some other reason? But I wrote down on there the favorite song of the people was "We Want to Get Out of This Place." And so people, had so many days to their deros and that, and but they did that in Korea too mm-hmm. when I was there. So I don't think that's anything different than Vietnam. But the other thing that to me just seemed awfully strange about Vietnam was that it was like a one-year war. You had a one-year tour, and yet people were dying. And, you know, as compared to the other wars that, you know, you're in until it's over, and you also are not constrained about, you know, you can't go any farther than this line. You know, I'm sure in the Korean War there were some constraints like that too, but not to the extent of what it seemed like Vietnam. It's like the American soldiers weren't able to do what needed to be done. And the part, some of this that's come out over the last weekend has really been interesting, thinking about the interview here, is that there's an article in the Dallas Morning News. It was about, oh, I think it was Friday. It was on the editorial page. And it was the individual that was talking about it. It says that there were really some people say that the America lost, first world war the American ever lost. He said there were two wars. The first one, Vietnamese War, and the second. He said first one with American soldiers in it, America won. The second one, when the American soldier was not there, and it was just the Vietnamese soldiers, and the support was not there, that one was lost. That was the political one. And I, you know, that's true in some respects. And you know, a lot of people have to affect, should we ever been there in the first place? I think for the time I went, and the reasons that that were given at that time were good reasons. At some point, as that thing drug on and on and on, you know, you wonder, why are you still there? What are you accomplishing? And I reached a point where, you know, I felt that we either all ought to go, you know, the biggest lesson learned in that, it was, to me, is what we did in Desert Storm, is the whole nation was behind it, and we either go locked arm in arm or we don't go. But we just, and that one just sort of stumbled into it. I don't know, it was whether we thought we could go in for a little while and then get out, or I don't know. You know, it was, again, my experience was, who really was running the show between the civilian leadership and the military leadership. And I think that was one of the, to me, in my perception, the disparity between military and civilian leadership, and then maybe not having the military leadership that would stand up and say, we're not going to do this anymore. Thinking about more about their own careers than about, which isn't true today, I don't think. So if there's, that to me is probably the best lesson. It's a tough way to learn that lesson with all the people dying. But America learned not to go into something unless they're prepared to go in to win and pay the price. That's my story.
Mm-hmm. Got a couple of questions about the evacuation hospital. Now, did you ever treat any civilians, Vietnamese civilians?
Yes.
I know you mentioned the MedCap missions, yes. But did you actually see patients at the hospital?
Emergencies.
Okay.
A good friend of mine there was an oral surgeon. And in fact, when he didn't have anything to do, he took my wisdom teeth out over there. In fact, I always remember the generator went out, so he didn't have any light or anything. And he could prop open the windows, and he said, well, all he needs this stuff to pull him out with anyway. So he did a lot of work on, there were some children that had cleft palate and some awfully looking stuff. And, I mean, he showed me some of the pictures, and I said, now, are you finished with this? I mean, it looks so bad. He's went so proud of it. I said, are you finished? But no, they certainly some emergency surgery, but most of what we took care of was, you know, where the American GI wounded.
Mm-hmm. Do you recall what kinds of wounds that were? Were there any types of wounds that the staff would see more so than the other wounds?
Most of them were, from amputations and from small arm, fire, from, mortars or from either that kind of trauma. I would say trauma injuries the most. And then there's, some of the ones from the poisonous, from the either snake bites or from a punji stick, that type of injury too. But primarily would have been caused by either a mine or, a weapon or something like that.
So at the evacuation hospitals, would they be stabilized and then transported on to other hospitals? Is that how the process would work?
Normally, and what happened in Vietnam is probably different than what the Army policy or doctrine had been in the past, where you would have a smaller hospital like a battalion aid station right up where the action occurred, and then you'd have a surgical hospital where they could do immediate surgery and so on. Well, what happened with the helicopter, they were flying into hot landing zones, and they would pick somebody up. They'd leapfrog whoever was the busiest, and so they'd either bring them to the surgical hospital or to the evacuation hospital. And in many cases, normally that evacuation hospital would be much farther back into the rear. But in Vietnam, everything was kind of jammed together, so all of those units were over there, so you didn't have the normal spread. So you would have some casualties coming directly from the battlefield, or they may have been stabilized already at a battalion aid station, and then come back to the emergency room of the hospital. And then we had, the dysentery and stuff and all that kind of stuff that goes along with that. And then some malaria too.
How secure was the hospital? Did you ever have any problems with
I think in the time that we were there, I think it was relatively secure. We had, in the time I was there, one rocket attack where the Viet Cong rocket attack. And I don't know, I don't really follow the history, but there was, I think, a nurse killed or at the hospital. But no one really injured at the time I was there. So based on that, I would say it was safe. That's not to say there wasn't the target for if there was some sort of terrorist attack or sapper. Like, we had a barber at the unit eventually over time, as it got more stable, you could employ Vietnamese. And so we would have even hooch maids that they would, do your fatigues, and we even reached that point of going from being in a unit where we didn't have, we were living on the ground, to going to where we had cement floors and Quonset hut and somebody making the bed and washing your fatigues and your stuff. And then we would pay so much to one of the officers who would be in charge of the fund. And then he was also paid the barber. And then one day the barber didn't show up, and we found out that he was a Viet Cong and gotten, shot the night before attacking the Harbin headquarters or something. So you just I guess it's just an example of whoever was the enemy over there.
You mentioned Arvin headquarters. Did you have much contact with either Arvin officers or soldiers?
No, I didn't. I went over there for some of the briefings were held over there, so they would be there. And a couple of the advisors that I had gotten to know, the medical advisor to the, like the two-core surgeon, they'd have a medical advisor that would be with them.
And wanted, did you attend any USO shows?
Yes.
Could you describe the show? Who did you see, for instance?
Bob Hope.
Mm-hmm. What was that like?
It was a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. I mean, from being just, it was at the time where we had been over there with nothing going on, you know, to all of a sudden have, we took a, you know, group from the, our unit, we took a group of soldiers out with us, and I don't even remember who was with him, but I think Ann Lerner. So that's about the era that we're talking about. And Bob Hope. And I mean, it was a very lively and entertaining. It was great.
What effect do you think it had on the soldiers?
Oh, they loved it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they were from everywhere. I mean, it was from the infantry division. And so, yeah, very much was that was worthwhile. We did have, in fact, we had from the USO show, we would have, there was, I think, one that came where some of the USO, like the show people, mm-hmm. came over and stayed at our evac hospital one time on their way to somewhere else. So saw a show and then saw some of the people, and, you know. But Bob Hope was the big person. But no, it was just like you see on mm-hmm. in the movies, where he gets up and tells all these jokes, and then the girls get up and dance, and Ann Margaret sang, mm-hmm. or whatever.
So. What about any instances of racial problems, racial tension, sometimes you... among anybody, any of the hospital staff, or maybe any of the soldiers that came through?
You know, there were some fights, so it's hard to say what. At that time, in our particular unit, we had some black NCOs. And we had, you know, white NCOs, and they pretty well kept control of the situation, if there was a situation. I mean, we sure had black soldiers and white soldiers, but there was never any, you know, like squaring off, mm-hmm. not in our unit. And part of it may be that people were so once. Particularly once we became an operational hospital, where people were working long hours, and you know, they partied hard, and but I don't think it. At least we never found that it was drugs. I mean, a whole lot of alcohol, but beer, and but not, you know, and not racial. The racial stuff was, in fact, we weren't even aware of what was going on. A lot of that wasn't in the Stars and Stripes.
Mm-hmm. Was that primarily how you received news from what was happening back home? And
Stars and Stripes,
Stars and
through
Stripes
letters.
And letters.
And I people writing to me were not, you know, likely to be talking about riots in Detroit. Yeah. But you'd get some of that, you know, and we'd get... some, you know, the things that it's not like the news of today. A lot of we got was filtered on through the Stars and Stripes, mm-hmm. and through the radio. So we had radio, and it wasn't until later that some of the racial things happened. Because mm-hmm. after I returned from Vietnam, I came back to Letterman Hospital in San Francisco, and Letterman was one of the primary casualty receiving facilities back in the States. So I got back there, I guess, in it would have been, by the time I took 30 days leave or so, about December of January of 69, maybe. 68, I'm sorry. And I saw some things that were, as far as seeing patients, that were worse there than I did in Vietnam. And particularly one of the, the hospital there, it was, they hadn't built their new high-rise hospital yet. It was like the long corridors. And so there were a lot of amputees, but the worst one was the burn ward. I mean, that was just, I mean, to go on there, I mean, and that had reasons I had to go. I mean, it was, that's where, you know, I really got a feel for why are we here, and if we're ever, you know, if we're going to get into something like that, we really need to not just let it go on. We need to get in there and win and end it, or not be there in the first place. There's too many people that were hurt forever over that. After taking a quick break, there were a couple of other items that I had remembered that I just wanted to say about some of the, idiosyncrasies of that whole experience over there. We were located in Pleiku, in the Central Highlands in Vietnam, and the out in, like in West Texas, where you have these dirt storms, mm-hmm. they would have the same thing over there, and they'd come through. And in the summertime, when it was hot, you know, and then of course we had monsoon season, and you had in the highlands, it was cold up there, but in the springtime or before the rains came, these dust storms would come through, and of course they had red dust up there. And so I always remember one day I was inside the tent, and of course my position was the, what they call the S1 or the adjutant, and responsible for the administration, and we had different reports that we had to send in. One of them was Vietnam lessons learned. We had to send lessons learned reports in all the time. I don't know whoever got them or whoever did anything with them. Vietnam lessons learned reports, and they had to go. At that time it would have been USRV headquarters in Saigon, and we were part of what was the 55th Medical Group. 55th Medical Group was in Quy Nhon, and so we may have sent the reports through the group to down to it was 44th Medical Brigade. It was the and they were part of the U.S. Army Vietnam. And one day I got a letter back through channel saying that something to the we have noticed that some of your reports are coming through with a red tinge on the paper. Can you see if you can make them? And it was just like, what are we doing here? Is this, it was like it's a peacetime operation. And they were going to start, what I did is I wrote back a letter through that same channel and said, we have a lot of environmental challenges up here, such as red clay dirt blowing around. Please visit. And I never heard back.
Did you get a response? No response.
No. There was discussion right before I was leaving, as they were going to initiate Inspector General inspection. See, in the peacetime, I mean, there's whole Inspector General inspection system that each particular installation or where each command has an inspector general who goes around in different units and looks at what they're doing, how they're doing, and they were going to start annual inspector general inspections. And, you know, here we are, I mean, in the whole, it was, again, it's just bizarre that you would be going down this road of a annual tour peacetime operation while the war's going on around you, and we're bringing patients in. And, it just seemed like the priorities were scrambled there somewhere. And then the only other thought I have is on the award system, the military award system. It kind of depended on where you were and what the policy at the time was and what kind of award you would get. There, for combat or for valor, I wouldn't speak to that at all because none of the people that I was involved in with had anything to do with that. So I wouldn't speak to that. But if you're talking about administrative kinds of units, like if you were at the, say, 55th Medical Group, the farther away you were from where something was actually occurring, or if you were located in, say, the 44th Medical Brigade, it was almost like a packet at the end of your tour of awards that you would get. And, you know, that wasn't necessarily true. Anybody up in our area, it depended on who happened to write the best and get something through, that it just wasn't the same. I guess that's probably true anywhere. But the whole, I guess what's the right word for this? The whole value of the award system, I think, probably has to be questioned over there, in my mind. Mm-hmm. Should be. Some people really earn them, some people didn't earn them.
Is there anything else you'd like to add about your time in Vietnam?
I don't think so.
Okay. When you came back to the States through San Francisco?
Yes.
Is that correct? Do you recall any?
Well, no, I came back through, flew back to Seattle, Tacoma.
Okay. Okay. Were there any demonstrations taking place at that time? Did you see anything like that?
What I wrote in my questionnaire there were a group of us that came back together that had been over there together. And I guess maybe about four of us. And we had some time on our hands when we landed at the Seattle-Tacoma Airport, and we were in uniform. And we walked into where you normally would go, and that would be the lounge. And a couple of people walked up to us, and we couldn't buy a beer. They bought a beer for us. So at least that early, in that part of the country, you know, again, I think in looking at some of what happened in Vietnam, you have to look at the time to judge or evaluate anything. When did it? When are you looking at versus what was the environment at that time? And I think it must have been at least in Seattle, Tacoma, that somebody who spent a year in Vietnam was worth buying them a beer. And I know that wasn't the case later.
What about, are you involved in any veterans organizations today?
Well, I do have, I am in the, as far as Veterans Affairs, I do have a disability through the VA. I mean, I'm part of the VA. Mm-hmm. It's not much. It's just a medical disability, hearing primarily. I'm a member of TROA, Return Officers Association. So I guess those two. I've been to a couple of VFW places and they're a combination. It's an interesting group there. There's kind of, I think, VFWs and kind of like they're searching for their World War II group is dying off, and then they, you know, the Vietnam era hasn't joined them.
Mm-hmm.
At least in the, I've been in a couple of places.
Were you well received as a Vietnam vet at the VFW?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I mean, and sometimes you hear instances where some vets have said they didn't feel
really
welcome.
Yeah. I'm not sure anybody really knew. Mm-hmm. I mean, just used it to go to eat or something like that. Rockford, Illinois, Fort Myers, Florida, a couple of different places.
Now, I know you were in the Army for 30 years. What did you do directly after Vietnam, after your time in Vietnam?
After Vietnam, I went to, the next assignment was to Letterman General Hospital there in San Francisco, and from there to went to about, I think it was January 69, to back to Fort Sam Houston for the next step in the process for officers would be the advanced course, officer advanced course, which is 6 months. So that was from January to June, and there I went from there to Walter Reed in Washington, D.C., and was assigned there in administrative company command position, troop command there, and then from there went to back to San Antonio in 1971, and that was for the Army Baylor Master's Program in Hospital Administration.
Just out of curiosity, during this time period, how close did you follow developments in Vietnam? After you had left Vietnam, did you watch the news, for
instance?
Very
closely, because I was concerned about going back. Yeah. Having, you know, especially as it went on and the casualties kept going on, and, you know, it just seemed like, what are we doing? So, yeah, I kept up real close. And, you know, the whole issue of the racial incidents and happening both in the military as well as, back here in the States. In fact, I always remember while I was at Letterman, I was a duty officer at the hospital the day that Martin Luther King was assassinated. And of course, with Oakland and San Francisco and the potential for that place blowing up out there. But no, I kept a very close eye on that until we were gone.
Is there anything else you'd like to add at this point?
No, I just would say, I guess, overall that I was probably lucky. There's a lot of people that had things worse. And that I still think that we went in for the right reason, but I think we didn't either have the right leadership, civilian and military, working together, or know when we should get out, or know if we should have been in there in the first place. I don't know. The reason seemed that it was appropriate. The lesson learned of is a hard lesson to the number of deaths. Was it worth that for knowing that you shouldn't get involved in something you're not totally committed to, the whole country's not committed to? That's my
Okay. Well, this concludes the interview with Mr. Phil Dorsey. Thank you very much.
Okay.